I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Who likes the bubbly champers? This guy. And I'll tell you what, I've never been so excited about champagne in general as right now. Small growers doing amazing things, established houses turning out better and better quality bottles. This is a fantastic time to be drinking champagne. Do you know who else likes the champers? Probably you. You probably know all this already and are drinking a lot of bubbles too, because unless I'm missing something, champagne is super popular right now. So what should you know to take your exploration of champagne even further? I suggest you sign up for the upcoming and amazing La Fête de Champagne, a spectacular event that has been organized by the esteemed Peter Leem, who's taught me more about champagne than any other living person, and Daniel Jonas, who is the force behind La Palais, the famous Burgundy Festival, and also one of the finest sommeliers in the history of that profession. La Fête de Champagne is going to take place in New York City at Astor Center on October 18th. That's coming up pretty soon. And there's going to be a gala dinner by some of the finest chefs that I've ever eaten the food of, including Danielle Ballou, Gunter Seeger, Abraham Brissell, and James Kent. It's going to be a multi-course extravaganza. It's going to be a BYOB champagne festival, and it's going to be spectacular. There will be a number of amazing producers there: Agropar, Barèche, Chartant & Taillé, Delamotte, Dom Pérignon, Drapier, Laval, Solos, Jacquesson, Prevost, Krug, Le Mondier Bernier, Roederer, Peters, Duquet, Philippe Onat, Paul Rouget. The list goes on. It includes Geoffroy, Salon, Savard, and Villemar. They're all going to be there. The producers, the chef de cave, will be in the house dining with you. A fantastic opportunity, and it's coming up soon. If you want tickets, reach out to 212-625-2519. Again, 212-625-2519. Or go to the website, lafetdechampagne.com. LAFETEDUCHAMPAGNE.com. We'll see you on the 18th.
Chicago. It has Lakeshore Drive. It has the Cubbies. It has Willis Tower. And now it has 750. That's right. The amazing 750 service is now available in Illinois. And that means that it's powerful and easy to use search tools for identifying wholesale pricing, locating trade tastings, saving lists of tasting notes, and much more, including the very excellent tool for processing credit apps, is now a click away for Chicagoland. To celebrate the launch, we here at the show are talking with buyers, distributors, retailers, and sommeliers from the great city of Chicago and releasing that series of episodes to you. What is going on in the Windy City? You're going to hear it from the people who know. And if you are tuning in from Chicago itself, be sure to give 750 a try. 750.com, it's in Illinois, and it's the future.
Fernando Beteta on the show. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here.
Yeah, very, very excited. Glad you're in Chicago.
Well, you know, yeah. Had to come back sometime. So you're a big wig at the old Tenzing Wine and Spirits, but how'd you get there? You were born in Guatemala.
I was. Kind of a very very chameleon background because I was born in Guatemala, but when I was 4 years old, my parents moved to Virginia. And so I grew up from kindergarten through middle school in the United States, and I thought I would stay here forever. And then we went back to Guatemala. I was 13 on a family trip. I loved it so much. My parents promised my sisters and I that they would buy us a pony if we did. Never saw the pony. Our cousins had like horses. We're like, oh, awesome. This country's great. And they went back because they were in the restaurant business. And they're turning now 40 years anniversary of their restaurants in Guatemala. And both of my parents are chefs. And it was just natural. I felt like that was what I was going to do. And you can imagine, like, growing up in a society in Virginia, I spoke like y'all. I was more Southern. And then going to Guatemala, getting picked on with my last name and just fitting in, I was sort of a rebel, and I never did well in school. I got kicked out of high schools.
And that's funny because, you know, you're fluent in languages and
yeah,
you've done well in school.
So English is like my mother tongue, and because I think in it, and it's what I read, and it just became easier. Spanish was harder because it wasn't used with my sisters and around the house.
It was just used by the guys making fun of you.
Exactly. So when I was 18, my dad wanted me to work directly in the restaurant. He's like, you don't need to go to college. He didn't go to college. He thought I could learn what I need to learn in the restaurant and one day take over it. But my mom was like, no, you just, you know, get an education. So instead of coming back to the States, because I didn't do SATs, I didn't get into that like program, I went to Europe. And first place was somewhere where the language is going to be easier. So I thought about like the Canary Islands. There's a hotel school. And then
the Canary Islands.
Yeah, you know, it's really big in Latin America.
Is that true?
Yeah, there's a hotel school there. And I didn't even know what these islands were. I just thought it was cool. It's an island. But I ended up choosing Florence, Italy, because I had a friend there and it would just move there. And
you're like, I can say San Giovese, but slowly, the Great Varieties and the Canaries,
yeah,
I don't
slowly
know.
Slowly learning the language. So now I'm like on my third language, 18 years old, living alone in Europe. It was the best time of my life. And I did all that hotel management basics, you know, service, restaurants, food and beverage, and marketing. And then you had to do a 6-month internship. And so my internships were in hotels in Sardinia and Rome, and everything was exactly what I wanted to do, go back to Guatemala.
I found Sardinia and Rome to be a little different.
Oh, yeah. But why?
Well, they're a little different.
Oh, yeah, very different.
You know, Rome's like this big metropolitan city with all this history, and Sardinia's this place with all this history where very sparsely populated, and there's shepherds going by and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very unique. So I came from, you know, that little town in Guatemala in the mountains, and then working in Rome, which is, you know, buzz and everything, and working at a high level with Michelin star chefs, and I just loved it. And Sardinia was completely, you know, more laid back, but it was still a resort. And it was 1997, ready to go back. My parents are basically, you're coming to work. I was maybe 23, and I get a call from my mom. It's like, no, you know what? Change the plan. Just stay in Europe. And they never really like, what? Why would you just want me to spend the rest of the summer here?
They never found the pony. Is that why? They were like, we just haven't found the pony.
Yeah, things aren't really going that well here in Guatemala because they had changed. They had ended a civil war that had gone on for like 35 years. She's like, it's not really great for you to come back and so forth. I didn't know until 3 weeks later that my sisters had been kidnapped. And I have two younger sisters who are twins. They were in high school, and my parents were completely like keeping me in the dark, so I wouldn't know. And they kidnapped them for ransom. And this was, they're fine now. They got through all of that, but it changed me completely from being this crazy kid who's, you know, had his future set by always thinking I was going to go back and work with my parents. And kind of taking it easy in Florence and these other places, then suddenly like, okay, they don't want me to come back. In fact, my parents wanted all the kids out of the country. And so they're like, we're going to send your sisters to live with you in Europe. Just figure out what you want to do. Like if you want to study, we'll help you in that sense. And that's how I kind of chose a further hotel school in Switzerland.
Do you ever talk to your sisters about that time period?
We do. And it's been what now, you know, 16 years, 17 years since it's happened. But I think it's all in the past, something that maybe my parents, because they remember that period, will recall it more around the anniversary, because I think it happened like in October or September, which I kind of forget about it completely. And it just comes up like this, like what really changed in my life that makes me who I am now? Everybody kind of always has something. I was just thinking about it today. I'm like, you know, I would be in Guatemala if it wasn't for this thing that, you know, just made me say, okay, I'm going to perhaps live in the United States or in Europe the rest of my life, and got me really serious about studying. So Switzerland became like, you know, a difficult school, had to learn French, because all my classes were in French, you know, marketing and accounting. And again, wine was another subject. And I really enjoyed it. Everybody could tell that I liked it. And having those four languages now fluently, easier to understand and so forth. So my final internship was in Thailand and worked on an island there and so forth. 3 years had gone by. I felt it was fine to go back to Guatemala. But by then, I kind of felt like I didn't have my friends from my youth. It was interesting. I loved working with my parents. They had now four restaurants, and I was 25, and I just felt like, you know, what do I do next? Do I stay here or do I do something else? And then that's how I ended up in Chicago, just basically through a friend of a friend who said, you should go work in Chicago. And I said, no, I don't want to live in the United States. I have no interest. Send me to Bangkok. I'll go work in Hungary. I'll go work in South America. But they're like, your background, you lived in the States, you speak English, makes sense. So there was a little convincing, but I took the job. That's how I ended up at the Ritz-Carlton.
And that's actually owned by the Four Seasons in Chicago.
Yeah, it is. And that's why it was interesting, because Four Seasons was a company I wanted to join, and then they told me about the Ritz-Carlton. And I was like, fantastic. I want to be a hotel manager now, live in a big city. I'd never been to Chicago, so I didn't know what it was going to be like, but loved it. The minute I came out of the train, saw it, became passionate with everything that the hotel was doing. And they had a big wine list. And it was kind of funny because I think about how there was a restaurant manager and he was a sommelier. But whenever the servers felt a little bit like they needed somebody, they'd be like, you, Francisco, Fernando, go talk to the table. I mean, you speak, you look European. They'll believe you. And I just BS'd my way with these customers. I'd always say things like, the wine is balanced, it's elegant, has a long finish, and never described the fruit, the flavors, or
even the story.
I've been doing
that for 15 years.
Exactly. Yeah. I tell everybody, just remember those three things.
It has good fruit.
Exactly. I had no knowledge of American wine. And I knew the Brunello di Montalcinos. I had heard of Bordeaux. Everything you would learn in hotel school. But it forced me to kind of like buy a book. And my boss said, buy the California wine and read Wine Spectator and so forth. And that's kind of how I started.
Because you came in what, the 90s?
2001.
Oh, actually. Okay. So yeah, 2001.
So after I'd graduated and after my internships and had spent a year in Guatemala, got this offer 2001, September 4th. So that whole, like, I thought I was going to lose my job after September 11th. I was still living in the hotel in a room when all that happened. But they didn't fire anybody. So it was even more reason to stay, because I think originally I thought maybe I'll do this for a year, but everything that happened in the world also was like, okay, maybe a year, 18 months passed before I knew I was involved in this hotel like a family. And the restaurant manager left. I became the manager and the sommelier, Grand Award wine list, and just really started learning more about wine. And I mean, Larry Stone had worked at the Ritz-Carlton. Like, he had been one of the sommeliers there. So there was these predecessors that had been there and I'd heard about, and I wanted to learn them. So I remember calling Larry Stone and saying, I want to be a master sommelier. What do I need to do? And he talked to me for an hour and started taking the classes and going to every tasting that I could. And it was kind of funny because I joke around that I'm the Slumdog Sommelier, because my background was never around wine growing up in the family until I was way into my college years. But because I had been like, in Switzerland, and then I'd been in France, I'd been in Italy, it was just remembering a little bit of that, piecing it together so that I could talk about it and learn it quicker.
Was there a conscious decision where you said, you know, I don't think management, I think wine?
That happened afterwards. It was, I passed my advanced sommelier and I was still managing, but I loved the people. I think the difference between management and sort of that front of the house and the sommelier society is like, they're like my people. I get them. They embrace the food and wine. They like the chef side. It's in our blood. It's whatever. Even though I still think management's there, but they're a little different from what we see. And I wanted to be that. So in that sense, it was like the decision of saying, I still want to be the restaurant manager. I want to make all decisions. I want to own my own restaurant, but I like the community. And so I found myself hanging out with them more often.
And who are some of those people that you're hanging out with?
At the time, Belinda Chang was living here. Scott Tyree was at True. There was a great group. Jamie Smith was somebody with Linda Violago at Charlie Trotter's, Seraphin. And they've all like moved on, become sommeliers, renowned all over the world. So inspiring here in Chicago, Alpana Singh. I think she inspired me the most because she was a minority, and they would always write the same kind of story. I mean, she's brilliant, but it was like she's a woman and she comes from like an Indian background, and then, you know, Indian women weren't allowed to drink, and so how did she overcome that? And I'm like, oh, I'm a woman inside. No. I'm like, well, I'm Guatemalan. I don't hang out with Guatemalan Latinos. It's different. Learning wine, like, huge hurdles. And I
Really, you don't see many Latinos in the wine business.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the only one from Guatemala. And then I know like three other mass sommeliers that are from either Chile or Mexico or Puerto Rico, like surfing. So it's not a lot, but yeah, I've inspired so many. And I think that's what I really, really get out of this is helping other people and, you know, saying, if I can do this, you can do this.
Did you ever talk to her about that?
Yeah, I told her all the time. I had like the biggest crush on her. Basically, because she, from what she was doing, she was a head sommelier. And
she was at Everest at the time?
At Everest, yeah. And I remember like saying, you're a master sommelier, and how can I become one? And she was always supportive of me and helped me. So she was great, I think. And now that we get to teach and we see each other at sommelier class intro, we kind of look back at that. And she's done so much with her career. It's amazing. And even like she just opened a restaurant. And I'm like, see, you inspired me again. Like, I wish I could do that, but I don't have the time or the investors that she does.
What was it that made you say, I'm going to take the Master Sommelier route?
I think there was a side group, a community here that was doing that. And I got the invite sort of like through the hotel, like, who wants to do this intro course? And I signed up. They're like, you actually need to do it. You're the restaurant manager. And then when the second level came around, my dad, they were like, you should do this. This is something I never thought I would become a master sommelier. I never imagined I would continue. But once I got involved and I did well, I liked it. And I enjoyed studying. I enjoyed the competitions. And when the Chaîne des Rôtisseurs was doing their young sommelier competitions, I'd do them, I'd win them, and I just, Master Sommelier was the program that seemed like it was, you know, the way to go. But I tell people there's many different courses, whatever you want to do. It's a great structure, but whatever's evolved, because I know every different one has its own, you know, pros and some are cons, but I like this group.
Well, it seems like you did pretty well in a fairly short period of time. You made it through in, what, 6 years?
Yeah, it was very quick. And I think it's because of the languages and my experience, like traveling and work. It wasn't so much the memorization. It wasn't the type that like takes flashcards and just studies them, but working with a great list, having mentors around you, having opportunity to taste, definitely accelerates your palate. If you're in a city or you don't have the support group, it's always going to be harder. I was sitting my first time the master when I was my first year in Nomi. So,
and what's Nomi?
Nomi is the hotel at the Park Hyatt here in Chicago. It stands for North Michigan. And it's still French influenced, and now it's like a little bit of American cuisine. But when I joined in 2005, it was Sandro Gamba, French guy, and they had a magnificent wine program, probably like 1,500 wine selections. And I said, wow. They're probably selling more wine in a day than we sold at the Ritz in the month.
Why do you think that would be?
It was just busy. There was this buzz. The amount of people that were walking through there every single night and actually drinking wine, ordering champagne, and diving into the cellars, older vintages, and tons of it. Really, you walk inside the restaurant, there's this giant wine cellar. It just calls for like wine. And there was a reputation. And the Ritz had lost its grand award because it just didn't keep up with adding more to their inventory. But few people knew that their cellar was like $1 million and it had vintages from the 20s and the 40s and so forth, like from Bordeaux, but nobody was buying them. You know, they were drinking Ferrari Carano by the glass and just admiring the wine list. Whereas Nomi, it's like you couldn't keep those on the list, the you know, the collector wines. You'd get your allocation and they'd fly. And it's exciting. I think that at the time, you know, people were spending it, and that was one of the restaurants you could do that.
Was it a goal of theirs to get a grand award?
It was at the beginning, and it was quite funny. My first year, we went to an auction. It was a live auction with the hotel food and beverage, with sommelier, and we wanted to get a case of mixed champagnes, like older vintages. We started trying to bid for it. This person in the front like kept raising his paddle, and we started raising it. We started getting, and then finally we won, and we're at the end of the auction paying for it. We had realized we were bidding against the president of Hyatt North America, Ed Rabin, who was a huge wine collector. And we were like, you are bidding for that? You know, you actually made us now like raise the price so much. But he was like, oh, wow, I love it. Actually, big wine collector. And he was very influential in like telling us how to grow the program.
What did he say?
Well, financially, he'd be like, he'd come in, like he knew his wine. So before the auctions, now we had to always meet together and say, okay, what do you want? What do I want?
Yeah, maybe pre-gaming.
Yeah, pre-gaming, yeah. Not do, because we'd bid against each other. We didn't want that. But he would say, you guys need to beef up your Burgundy list or something. He'd say, you guys should really spend some attention on this or get this winemaker. So I mean, when that happens from the very high level in the top, you get coolers installed right away. I mean, one phone call and the general manager is telling you, I got a call from Ed Rabin at corporate, and he said, blah, 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 blah. I don't understand, but
yeah, yeah.
He said, blah, blah,
something
blah,
about wine blah, blah, cooler, blah, cooler arriving Wednesday.
And can you just buy them? Can the chef just give them to you? Can you just make this happen? Was kind of the way, and we would be like, great. And some of that support happened with like giving us extra rooms for storage. I mean, we had to take up 3 parking garages in the, on the 6th floor to add 8 or 9 Eurocabs. So that kind of, you know, doesn't happen in a hotel with a management that doesn't want to, you know, put in that investment. But when they were around, it happened, and it was fantastic. And then everybody moved around. So it does change a little bit when the hotel manager is like, you have how much in inventory?
Yeah.
And then they're used to working with smaller wine lists. So.
But if it's selling, it's selling.
It sounds like it was selling. It was, and it still does. They say they sell more bottles because there's more people, but at a lower price. And also the economy changed. I mean, I went through a period of 6, 7, 8, and then 9 was already like slowed down. And I was asked to, you know, reduce the wine list and the amount of purchasing and just kind of manage it a little bit more. And you can only raise the price on certain things and that, you know, end up looking like you're gouging people. So that's difficult. And that's why your first question is like, how did I end up at Tenzing? Because I was very happy. I had passed my master sommelier exam. I wanted to work the floor as a master. I didn't want to go behind a desk somewhere. I was traveling a lot more. I was getting asked to go do these like courses. I was and that was taking time away from my job at the hotel. And I couldn't just keep asking for a week off here, a week off there. And I was starting to think of like what other direction, what other job I can do and still enjoy everything that has to do with wine. And Ken Fredrickson, who's the founder of the company, he's a master sommelier. And he was my friend. He had moved to Chicago, had been to know me, and he was already talking about just starting a new company. And I didn't know
what was he saying?
I don't know. He was just kind of saying, I'm going to start a company, and it's going to be brilliant. And I asked him, what do you mean? We're going to have... he didn't want to say the word distributor, because I think in his mind, he wanted it to be a service-minded company that would change all the words and the lingo that you use for like wholesale distribution to a service. It was difficult to say because I really didn't know. I'm like, you mean we want to be an importer or distributor? And he's like, yeah, that's the short answer. And he had experienced that. He owned one in Nevada before. So he wanted to start from scratch here.
Yeah, that's where I met him was when he was in Nevada.
Yeah, in Nevada time. Wine Agents. And he did really well there. It was very successful. I had a lot of challenges along the way and in that kind of market.
Because I remember he came with Rob Bigelow once for dinner.
Yeah. Yeah. He knows everybody in the business. And it was amazing. If you know Ken, he has a lot of friends, a lot of connections, and he's able to put together an amazing book in a short amount of time.
In Chicago,
yeah. And Douglas Morello was another master sommelier. And the three of us were kind of set to open this new company. It didn't have a name. and he went to, he was in Nepal and he was in the Himalayas on a trip vacationing. I think he was with Raj. Raj probably took him to India, and he heard about the word Tenzing and what that meant. And Tenzing is a very common name, and it means equilibrium, balance. But it's also the namesake of our inspiration, who was Tenzing Norgay. And Tenzing Norgay was the Sherpa guide that led Edmund Hillary up Mount Everest,
sure,
1953.
First climb, right?
Exactly. And the story was the same. Like, we are guides, we're Sherpas, we'll carry the hard load. We know the route. Let's say we're the experts. And then the customer or the importer or the winery, the little guy in Austria, they're the people that we're trying to get them. Because to many, Chicago might like be like the Everest. How do they navigate all the laws and all the service? And so at the end of 2009, basically December, it all kind of started to come together. He told me, I really want you to come work with us. And
what was the proposition when they sat down? What did they say?
Exactly. Because I said, I don't know anything about distribution. I don't know if I'm going to enjoy it. And he said, you just continue to be yourself. And I think what I was doing was that I was very active in the community with tasting groups and with events. And I could get a group of sommeliers to know me late night and drink Pilsner Urquell and make pig. And so he knew I had a lot of influence, that people in general like me. And he said, we really want somebody to be in this company that knows service, knows wineries, people respect it. If we told them, you know, you're on board, they'll get it. And it's not just like, you know, this business person, and that I love teaching. So it was the director of education role. So he basically said, look, I don't like titles. In fact, our first business cards never had titles, but he said, I want you to be the person that can help write our blog, do social media, you know, get your Twitter people involved so that when we open this company, it'll be interesting. We'll have some following, we'll have some interest. And he said, continue to do what you do. Like, and so our offices have space to do events. And this morning I was doing a tasting group with 10 younger sommeliers who are going through that process and learning. And it's part of my job, so it's fun. I don't feel guilty like I have to take time away from work. It's getting them excited, and every day is different. One day it's, you know, interviewing a winemaker. Another day it's going to a restaurant and doing staff trainings. So I still train, you know, 1,000 people or more a year through different like classes or seminars, and still sell wine, which we all love to do.
So instead of the hotel staff, you're training other sommeliers or aspiring sommeliers.
Yeah. So our company is quite small. So Tenzing Wine Spirits in Chicago, we are about 13 sales guides. So we call them guides. So it's,
well, it's not quite small. That's,
yeah. Yeah. Know, for Chicago, medium yeah. size.
You know, there's the companies with like 2 guys.
Yeah, there's companies with 500 people. But they are a lot smaller for sure. We put them through 4 hours mandatory training every single week. And it might be a subject that we don't even sell. Like I did a tasting on Madeira just so that they know what's out there. And whenever I'm relating maybe a brand or a story of a producer, we go out and buy some other bottles from different people and get them excited about wine in general, what we love. Because most of the time, myself, I continue to buy wines that we don't sell just because, you know, they're great wines, great producers. And doing a lot of events, it's crazy how many little events we do in that little base camp is our offices.
But it sounds like kind of a generational change for distribution in Chicago, because here you have a distributor that's run by sommelier types, or at least there's several calling the shots in the company, as opposed to more liquor types. Did you see that as a change at the time?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, it ruffled a lot of feathers. Still a lot of joke, like how many MSs does it take to work in a company? And yeah, we all, the three of us still, you know, appreciate where we come from, but we are not the ones who are going to wear a pin every single day. We're not saying we're master sommeliers and like learn from it. I think we're all, each have our strengths, and Ken will be the first to tell you that he's not as active in the court, that he's not doing the course. He doesn't know how it drains, that he's business. He knows how to run a business really well. And he lets me do all that. And then Douglas, he's a great sales director. So he knows how to lead a team. I don't like to manage people. I think I love managing my bottles and my books, but he's very good and motivating his staff and doing the numbers thing. And so people outside at the beginning were kind of like looking at the company, but I think from the beginning they liked that we were trying to do what we always wanted a distributor to do to us, like
what service. You wish had been around before.
And so our culture came in really different. You know, we don't wear a tie and jacket everywhere. We have this office that's very relaxing. We first had a ping pong table. It's still there. We don't use it as often, but you know, you listen to music and you have some good coffee. And
does that mean you got beat badly at ping pong and you're like, screw this, I'm not playing anymore.
I'm not playing this. 2012. You know, it was at the beginning when it was slower, but now we're too busy. But we've always trying to do things that are kind of outside the box.
There's a chef there, right?
Yeah, we have a full-time chef, and he worked at Bradley Ogden. He's worked with Charlie Trotters. I mean, that caliber chef. And when we do an event, we're going to have some awesome, you know, producer from Burgundy, but we want to pair it with tacos, and he's going to make pulled pork and carnitas, just completely different, and he can do that. Or if we have the German winemakers, we do currywurst and make the pretzel in the office. And people like that. It's not so formal, that we can kind of be a little playful with it. This morning we did a garage sale, and people were like, I love the format, and kind of come in. And we originally wanted it to be like, bring three things that you want to sell at the garage sale, like a lamp, a book, the old Atari 64, whatever. People get it. We use a lot of different marketing fun things. And that's what I get to do too with my design graphics. Like if you know Andre Mack, like
I do, yeah.
Exactly. Like I see the stuff he puts out and I want to copy it, but I love it. I dig it. I get what he does. And we sell his wines here in Chicago, and they fit perfectly when we go out with a sell sheet, that instead of having, you know, technical information on the wine, there's whatever, there's a chicken
something
on
that
it. And
relates
egg.
At a cultural level.
Yeah, and people are like, I want to put that on a t-shirt because I think that's so cool, and they keep it. And that's been the culture that we've had at Tenzing since the beginning, that people like want to keep the invites that we've sent out, and every single month, a different cover on the price book and design them in it. I've had like, you know, borderline cease and desist letters. Never happened, but be like,
so
really,
is Andre, actually.
Yeah, you're gonna like put Tenzing on a Wendy's French fries and Arnold Schwarzenegger with a Tenzing tattoo on his back, like kind of funny things like that.
There's definitely been some shirts that have been recalled from the Mac production line because of that same concern.
But you need to do that. You know, you push
the limits a little
push
bit.
The limits and
limited edition.
Yeah. And I couldn't do that, of course, in a corporate way at the Hyatt or whatever it's called. Like it was always, I think I had a lot of ideas and I wanted to be creative, but it always had to be very restrained. And today, sometimes we start off with this crazy idea, you know, for our events, and we want to have cowboys and burlesque dancers, and then we want to have like a Chinese dragon coming through the tasting, and, you know, little people on stilts, and all that kind of stuff happens at the brain, you know, storm session, and then we tame it back. But we go out with the crazy ideas. We want to do stuff like that.
I found that sabering on stilts is more difficult than you'd think. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So the core man will do that for us now. Like, finally a bottle that sabers itself.
What are some of the other mainstays of the book? You mentioned Andre Max wines. What are some other wines that you find regularly sell in the Chicago market?
Chicago's very domestic. It's really heavy domestic. We drink a lot of California, Oregon wines. They do well in the restaurants. But we're mostly import. For some reason, we gravitate to what sommeliers like. So we built a very hefty French book. So we have producers like De Monti and Burgundy. We carry the Wilson Daniels stuff. So we have Romane Conti. But Robert Bohr has the Rouleau, Kermit Lynch. So every little region that you could think of, sometimes the obscure things from Corsica. But then a very strong Italian book. Every region is well represented. So Germany, like we were tasting Austria, but we've pretty much tried to cover the entire world. Just like when you build a wine list at that level, you always want to like, maybe we should add some Slovenian wines. We need to carve out a little section of New Zealand, but not just one region. We try to find things from the north and Wahike, and we find things in central Otago. So it's always balanced. And Australia is probably the one that we don't have yet, but we have a meeting tomorrow. And just kind of continuously putting together a little great wine list so that we can go to a restaurant and be like, look, any of these wines would fit your program. And we don't have anything too big, which is good. Our culture is still trying to keep.
You mean in terms of volume?
Yeah. I think that's, you know, millions of cases or hundred thousands of cases. I mean, some of our, I mean, if we sell 1,000 cases of something, that's amazing. So we're still trying to keep them small, mostly focusing in restaurants and retailers. And we don't sell to grocery stores. We just don't have the volume. So I think that's why Tenzing won't ever outgrow itself. Like, if we do, we'll go to another state or we'll do something different. And that's why we also have sake and spirits.
And so what's the spirits portfolio like?
The spirits is, it's really crafty. Since the beginning, we were like, we were ahead of the curve on that one for sure, because nobody was doing these, you know, the bitters and the maros and things like that. And portfolios like Domain Select were in Chicago, but they were completely under service. Nobody knew the cool stuff they had. And Anchor Distilling, which was Price Imports, was another one. I mean, they had Luxardo and it had Armagnacs, all these little fantastic producers. And when we started working with them, suddenly all the bartenders, mixologists were like, wow, and fantastic. And you can order from you and only order one or two bottles. You don't have case minimum. We didn't have a minimum delivery charge. So we were selling little bottles of bitter, like the Bitter Truth, for $4, and that would be our delivery. And eventually now we grow, but it's fantastic to work now with producers directly from, you know, mezcal, and we're going a lot into the Asian spirits, Japanese whiskeys, which are really exciting now, from stuff from Taiwan.
Seems like it's really blowing up, the Asian spirits.
It is. I mean, I think it was always things that we wanted to really drink ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I remember at the beginning, we're like, we're not going to have vodka. You know, it was hard to find vodka, and that was like the category that sells the most. But we would find a little, you know, organic potato grower from Sweden or one from Pennsylvania. And that's how people started really seeing the integrity in the selection process, in the quality. And now we there's a distillery opening up every week, it seems. We're getting all the samples because people think, you know, I'm small. I need somebody to tell the story. All these sales guys are like wine focused. They know they're not talking the spirits lingo. They understand terroir, and that's what I'm doing. They understand
less brand driven.
Exactly. And they know how to sell these difficult wines. So it's immediately plug and play, and that our sales staff like see something, you know, in the Jura, they'll go, oh yeah, I know how to sell that. I love it. I enjoy making my cocktails. We used to make them, train them how to mix a cocktail, which cocktails were shaken versus stirred. I mean, that we've gone a long way in 4 years, but it seems like you walk in a restaurant that doesn't have a Manhattan or an old fashioned, you're like, it's not worth its grain and salt, right? Or a craft beer. So we're just now starting to get a little bit into that craft beer stuff. And it excites me because I'm still the wine person, but always learning more.
Has there been a lot of profit movement on the craft spirits? Has it really been a mover for you?
It is. It has for sure been those products that are easier to manage than wine, because if you get a spirits placement, it stays on for a year, if not longer, and there's no vintage changes. It's easier to manage in the warehouse, and the margin's always a little bit higher. But they change a lot too, because sometimes they outgrow themselves and they become bigger brands and they have to go to a different distributor.
But that does seem like an evolution.
Yeah,
these guys do more and more volume and then go to a different thing.
Yeah, or they get purchased or something. So I think right now it'd be like 30-70. So 30% of our revenue is still coming from spirits. I mean, we'd love it to be higher because the margin's better. It's easy to manage, like I mentioned. But I think we don't want to be a spirits company only. And people remember that, you know, we're very wine-focused and, you know, even sake. We have a complete expert that does sake, and we have somebody that does spirits to always keep each person managing their own group and producers and talking to the breweries. And
is Chicago a spirits town in a way?
Oh my God, that's unbelievable. I think you can find that there are more celebrity bartenders in Chicago than there are celebrity sommeliers, for sure. The just with like places like the Aviary that is doing things that are absolutely like innovative and forward thinking, and Charles Jolie, like he's winning competitions everywhere he goes because they're really pushing the boundaries. But then there's like tiki bars and the Paul McGee's that are very good at what they do, and they make them crafty and original. And the neighborhoods, I think people in the Midwest, they love beer. They know the brown spirits are very popular here. So It's a big, big spirits town.
So what's a typical day for you?
Favorite days is like when there are winemakers and I get to ride along with them and take them to see customers. Because I'm not very good at driving. I get lost more. Usually get a ticket and I have to valet. But I enjoy talking with them and then telling their story or hearing their story and going to the different sommeliers. And seeing that sometimes people don't know them. You know, like if you think of a great producer, like I'm riding with Etienne Monti, and I think he's like one of the greatest. Just getting those appointments with a sales guy might not happen. But if it comes from me, then they're willing to give me some time. And they're like, Fernando, who is this person? I'm like, this is Tim Malti. His wines are not have not always been available in Chicago. Maybe that's why you don't know him. But in New York, they do really well. In France, they're always sold at auction and whatever. So that part of the sales, I'm just not good at asking for the sale. So I leave that to the salespeople.
You consider yourself a kind of a soft sell personality.
Absolutely. I want to tell them exactly, because it's the hard thing about being on this side is that we do have to sell. It's not like people think that sommeliers, because they have knowledge, that they can move to the side. You have that captive audience. You have people that come in your restaurant that are going to buy a bottle of wine. And they have no choice but to pick wines that you already picked. Unless they're bringing in BYO, right? They're going to take your suggestion. We have a scenario now where nobody needs our wine. Nobody, there's so much wine out there. There's good wine out there. And they're going to, you have to overcome sort of that barrier of like, this is our service. We'll do what we need, you know, we'll tell you the story, provide the same day delivery, the next day delivery, clean up if there's any mistakes. You're always, you've gone from the being the ass kissy to the ass kisser, right? And it's always difficult managing two customers. You're, you know, your buyer and also your customer as your, the producer, and you have an obligation to keep them happy. So there's a lot of service. So I think that's why we really do well. We enjoy all that service mind, and you know, if things go well, it's golden.
Have there been aspects of that that have surprised you? Have you said, boy, I just wasn't expecting that to be so easy or so difficult or that way?
I think every day there's something that, you know, you need to learn the terminologies and the business and the movement of wineries and how they will change. Distribution in the United States is very difficult because every state is like their own country, and learning the laws and going through the pricing grids and all the different levels is something that I'm still learning. And so in that sense, I thought it was always easy to find a wine. That's what we get requests sometimes from our buyers, like, can you get me this wine like next week? I'll put it on the wine list. And no matter how fast you work, you can't do the things that quickly. And then there's so many laws and back labels and things I'm learning. So, and just pricing is one of those things. I couldn't believe how the prices can change and influence people. Because I thought, if I put this wine on, it's $50. It's really good. You're going to like it. No, you know, it has to fit that price point, and it can be crap, but that's what they want. So we always try to find things of value, but we never like undermine the quality. So we wish we had some wines that were in the, you know, $6 range all the time, but most often not. We have things that are more geeky sommelier, and they fit in restaurant lists.
What are the price parameters for Chicago buyers normally? What is the range?
Well, I think it's definitely changed just because of the restaurant scene, that the fine dining restaurants are a lot less, and that everybody wants to make it more casual. So that sweet spot on a wine list here is 60 to 75. And then, yeah, there's the California wines that go on there for 200 or above, but nobody's really buying, you know, unknown or small regions that are just going to sit on your wine list. We're not really big Burgundy city, even though there's...
Well, it's hard to find Burgundy in that range, because that's like 20, yeah. 25 wholesale.
Yeah.
So you'd be talking about Pasta Grande or Bourgogne Rouge.
Yeah, but even here with anything, you know, at village level that you want to sell for $30, $35, it's going to end up on a wine list for two or three times the price, depending. It's hard because the Chicago, you know, consumer's still going to go to California for that price range. And if you buy anything a little higher than that, of course, then somebody can't sell it or just stays on the list. And the restaurant scene has changed a lot here. I think even where I used to work, the Ritz gone, the dining room's gone. Nomi concepted to a more casual kitchen, casual fare, where you can have a burger. Versus before, I remember I got yelled at forever serving a burger in the restaurant. And then Charlie Trotter's closed, and Avenues, the Peninsula, so all the hotels sort of got away with that five-star, five-diamond service. We still have great restaurants, but they're a little more casual, and they, when they have the tasting menu, they're kind of set to it, to enjoy it with wine tasting, with the flight. So the sommeliers aren't selling a big list. They're not going to propose the buyers, even though that's the time when, you know, you have people that are going to spend the money or that are willing to, you know, go into the wine list. But they, the pairings are very important. So we'll see if there's a couple more restaurants that open up that are very food driven and have great wine lists and a, you know, sommelier. There's some great sommeliers here, no doubt. But
what are those sommeliers like? I mean, what's the community like in Chicago these days?
Oh, I mean, it's great. There's a lot of people that have moved here recently. So Dan Pilkey's from California. Rachel Lowe spent a lot of time in California and in other cities. Now they're at the Trump, and she's at Spiaggia. Alpina's opened her own place. So they're very close. It's very small. I feel it's not competitive. Most everyone here gets along. There's no big egos. But there's not a lot of, like, wine jobs. So if a big wine job opens up, it's kind of like stays within the community. People know and can refer other people. I haven't had anyone really move from out of town that I know. Or if they are, they're young and they're kind of learning in the process.
Are there things that kind of separate the Chicago scene in terms of the wine personnel, the staff, from other cities that you visit? Or is there something you think, oh, well, that's definitely a Chicago way to go about it?
Here, they've definitely become more casual as the rest of the country. You see a lot less sommeliers wearing a suit and, you know, the double Windsor tie and so forth. It's, I think, more approachable. Wine lists now are just paper, right? You don't get handed a book with leather bound and so forth, or an iPad or any of that. So
the cellars are a little bit smaller generally.
Cellars are a lot smaller here, yeah. Except, you know, a couple of the hotels and steakhouses. People like steakhouses here are crazy. We have one on every corner. And those are always going to be good for that style wine, right?
Like, is that a factor in the way that California wine sells in Chicago?
That absolutely could be true. I mean, that seems like be the logic. People are visiting business. They have expense account. Everybody wants to eat at a steakhouse. Even our producers, like, when we have traveling Europeans and they go, we want to eat steak, because that's what they hear. They think Chicago is meat. And we're like, well, we have this great restaurant where they have some great French food, and they kind of laugh at us. There's some good Asian restaurants, amazing sushi, but maybe not as good as the coast for sure. But we always want to introduce them to the different restaurants. And
what's the retail scene like?
Retail's good. There's a lot of small independent retailers. Craig Perman, very esoteric selection. You can still go to the neighborhoods. And when you go around Chicago, you see that people like to support local. They're very, very local. I mean, that word has been overused, it seems like. But people, if you're from the town, they'll support your business more than if it's coming with a brand name from out of town, out of state. That's why chefs that have tried to open restaurants here, Samuel Markison and even Wolfgang Puck, like, they put their name on the...
Because his name's Marcus Samuelson, yeah. So I guess really don't know. Exactly. It really didn't last very long for him.
Yeah.
What's his name? Came here?
Never. I saw his picture. He did two events. But if you're from here, forget it. Like, I mean, it has... People are from that school of Trotters or from another great chefs, and then people will support them. So I think the same with a wine shop, people tend to buy in the neighborhood. In Chicago, I mean, if you go to, like, my neighborhood, Lakeview, you have houses all residential, and then in a corner you see a bar. And I think those are grandfathered in because there's no way you would ever be able to get a liquor license anymore to open up a bar in a neighborhood. Like, so it adds a lot of personality to the city. On the south side and north side, and just like having Wrigleyville, people love the city and love drinking. And
Is there a high-end collector culture in Chicago?
There's a lot of millionaires and billionaires in Chicago that are collecting. So you're going through one of these big auction houses. You don't really see the smaller gray market. I remember like even talking to sommeliers now, like asking them where they buy, where they source. Not everybody is familiar with like how to buy with gray market and where to go. And they're just afraid to go in auction houses because everything's in a case. So you can't really build a wine list quickly if you're just buying cases of Lafitte, you know, for $40,000.
In a way that restaurants and hotels have given way to, whether they're in groups or individual, but other independent restaurants, it seems like independent distributorship has also sort of taken along with that. So you have a new generation of distributors kind of matching a new generation of restaurants, and then some select retailers working with more kind of personal items kind of working together, or is it just a coincidence that the things are happening around the same time?
I think it's they're kind of working together because and happening at the same time just by pure demand and how things have evolved. We have around 80 small distributors or 80 licensed distributors in Illinois. The majority of them are all in Chicago. Now, we can service downstate because there's cities in South and Peoria and Springfield that are never serviced by any of these small producers. So if you're going to start a little Northern Italian distributor, you bring in some great wines when you're only seeing them in downtown Chicago. So I think that there's a little bit of expansion. There's some, hopefully, some unification with help from bigger distributors for warehousing and things like that that could help. I know some small distributors all warehouse at the same place so they can manage their costs and get that like distribution out a lot easier.
What about the social media side of it? It seems like that's always been a big concern for you.
Yeah, social media, I mean, as you know, it's difficult to do that full time because what we really wanted to do is whoever was doing the social media or the handle was actual person who had, you know, the voice of the company and not just getting an intern to like be posting information and deals. So when I think in 2009, Ken wanted me to take that because I had a Twitter handle. I can't remember. I think in 2008 or 2007 that I signed up for it and I had a couple hundred followers and he's like, do that for the company, start, you know, a Twitter handle. Now I have like four or five or six, I can't even remember how many, and I enjoy it. That's where I get my information. So we learned like to create our river of information and follow the right people and then distill that down and then spread it. So I'm always seeing what's happening around the world and what's happening, especially like in New York and London and San Francisco. So then we can either apply it here or come around, play with it. But having a lot of fun, like I needed to create a lot of content that just didn't exist. I didn't want to retweet everything. So I started interviewing our winemakers when they would come into Tenzing and sit down with them and talk to them about, you know, Burgundy and what they do and explain biodynamics and then all these themes that wasn't too salesy so that the end consumer, if they ever like stumbled upon this video, it was a master sommelier asking a winemaker about Oregon. And we started getting a lot of people following it. And I think that grew organically. And we, you know, 100 videos, we started doing, I mean, we wanted to do podcasts, but like no time to do that. But then,
there's no market in podcasts.
It was hard. Like, but Facebook was one. It was seriously when 2009, looking at the competition, nobody had a Facebook page. So that was one of the very first things that we started getting a lot of information. Now everybody has a Facebook page, but we're just trying to think of ways to become more innovative, to do it differently. Maybe we did QR codes for one, like summer. Who does that anymore, right? It's like we always try to stay current with technology. And I'm the guy. I think at the office when there's new people and I'm not introduced properly, they honestly think I'm the IT guy. And they're like, hey, I hear you're Fernando. Can you fix my phone?
Do they talk slowly like that to you? Like you don't speak English?
My computer.
My telefono is not working.
Yeah, my computer is like not working. Do you know how to install? You know, I'm like, I only know how to do that because I I don't know. I know how the technology works. Like I can charge my phone and put my email on my phone. But yeah.
Did you show them the MS and say it doesn't stand for Microsoft?
Yes. That's a new one. Yeah, Microsoft. Exactly. And it happens still till even Friday. Like I'm working on a map and because I'm also doing Google Earth and I'm known for that on social media because I would like retweet or like find these really cool maps of wine regions and post them. And the wine community was like, oh, that's cool. I never saw that. So I started creating my own, like going on Google Earth, mapping out the regions, coloring them in. And then suddenly I get it like, excuse me. Oh, we can't get the TVs to get the sound. And we have a presentation on PowerPoint. And then the salesperson from this company wants to know if he can use a Mac. I'm like, really? there's a remote control. Like, so I'm the IT guy / education / social technology. And furthermore.
What would you say to the next generation of minority sommeliers? You know, you said it was important to you to find role models who seem to be moving up in that field. How would you approach a younger person who hadn't made it yet, who maybe didn't look like all the other sommeliers?
Well, I think if you're young now and you want to get into this, it's hard because everybody wants to do it really quickly. Like young buyers want to become the head sommelier or the wine director very quickly without having been, you know, a cellar rat for several years, understanding how the prices and how to negotiate, how to think long-term and age some wine. So finding a mentor or working in a restaurant that has a, you know, a real focus and service-minded with a good wine list is not going to change every 6 months is important. And also like, you know, traveling and going to the wine regions and doing all that. I think there's a lot of people forget, like you can, but you see people opening up like Northern Italian restaurants, Italian, and I've never been to Italy. And I'm like, that's hard. It's like me trying to do Chinese food. What other people are doing, right? Do what you know. And I think if you get the opportunity to travel, it for sure will help you in your experience. Social media, and I don't know if you're talking about like younger someone. Yeah, if they're active, you know, that's a great way to promote themselves because nowadays it's like you can have your 15 minutes of fame. It seems like it's 15 seconds, right? Everybody wants to be on top of it. So you need to follow the people you need to interact with, and the opportunities to like ask a winemaker or an editor at a wine a question and get an answer right away. People start to ask, like, who is this person? You know, believe you. And then your customers also will see what you're doing. It should be a requirement. I think we have as a requirement, everyone had to get a Twitter handle. Everyone, salesperson, driver, the office people, and I like posted on our website. Not everybody can do it as often, but it was like, it's your job. You're delivering a case of wine at this new restaurant, tweet about it. And then I'll retweet. I'll handle sort of like, you know, putting an image on there, putting it on our website, but get the word out because you're not following the right people. You don't know what's going on. We need that market intelligence all the time. It's
one of the things that's interesting about you is that I think some of your humor doesn't always come through on the professional side. And I wonder, has it always been easy for you to engage your whole personality into the profession? Like, is there a part of you where you think, this is what a wine guy is supposed to be like, and there's a part of me that doesn't quite fit into that?
Obviously, I mean, I think you know me a little, and you can always say, like, am I holding back a joke, or am I holding back? People always, and it is true, because when I'm in front of a customer, I'm in, you know, in a restaurant, I want to be as professional as possible. When I was the manager, you know, like, you do a sales meeting, or you have a presentation at pre-shift, people always thought that was very serious. And then I go in the back and I like mess with the room service people, and like the Filipino room service attendant, I'd be like, "Tadalo, bagade, anybody?" And like messing with them, and they're like, "Fernando, you know you're funny." And then like turn around and be like, "I'm not." And I think there's a lot of this dry sense of humor, but at the office, I mean, just so you know, 10 years working in the hotels, I was Fernando. And when I started working at Tenzing, I'm Fern. Not that I they picked it up on it. I started introducing myself more like my sisters call me or my friends call me, and they would just use me by my nickname. So I didn't feel comfortable having people at the hotel, like 200 employees, just call me Fern. So yeah, I always wanted to be a little serious in one scenario, but now I'm like much more relaxed. They call me Furnace or Inferno, and the funny, you know, jokes start coming around, and they'll be quick to say that I kind of have like the most jokes in the office and borderline, you know, inappropriate things, but never bad. I'll never like drop like F-bombs in a meeting. I kind of restrain that. So if when I do, everybody takes it a lot more serious because they're like, I'm not used to you like, you know, cursing or, but the jokes, they come out all the time.
And where do you think that comes from? Is your family like that?
Oh, my dad's a huge joker. My dad's always been a clown. He has a great sense of humor, and I just enjoy it. It's like making people laugh. I think that that's the way to get, you know, people to like you. You always had to be the joker. In high school, it was like the class clown. You know,
did that have to do with moving around a lot?
Probably. I never was afraid of making friends, but I just wasn't good in anything else, but like sports, or I wasn't particularly smart, or I wasn't on the, theater. I didn't do anything. So to become popular, it was just joking. And I actually took a route where I would be different. And I had friends and we would kind of, you know, paint our hair, or like get more earrings than other people, or ride skateboards in a little town in Guatemala that's cobblestone streets. Doesn't make sense. but people
wears like, out the vans yeah, really quick.
My aunts thought I was like in gangs and was a drug dealer or something, because I'm like, your son. Because my mom would be like, no, he's a good boy. And I never did anything like that or illegal, but definitely just always joking. But I enjoy picking fun at myself first. And when I can do that, people kind of relax, and then they're like, okay, I'm making fun of who I am, either as a sommelier, as a master sommelier, or like the view of something that we do. Just so that people understand that it's more relaxing. We should just enjoy it, have fun, and it is funny. And they say that in humor, there's always a bit of truth. So that's why I'm always trying to find a joke that has a little bit of truth to it. And I think I play a lot with words, especially when I'm like on social media, and I hear phrases, and I'm always I think in sales I'd be really good, like in marketing, because I spin them around or something. Maybe they're not funny like originally, but then I tell it to other people and I see what they think, and then I'm like, okay, I like to share some of these things that happen in my mind.
And what are some of the avenues that takes? I mean, what does that sound like?
Pinot Grigio tastes like chicken. You know, it's one of those things, like we love Pinot Grigio, and it's like tastes like anything, you know, or you're blind tasting, you know, there's no crying in blind tasting, right? Because there's things that we would see in each other. I think one of the wordplays I did once on Twitter was Chateau du Heart and You're to Blame. You give Lafitte a bad name.
That's funny.
You know, it sounds like a song. And then if you know the wine, that Chateau Lafitte owns Chateau du Heart Rothschild. So it's like, you know, you give Lafitte a bad name because you're not first growth. And then some people are like, the joke's too long. But I'm like, ha, 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 laughing at like how that makes sense. Or Israel is making mad Iran. And then they read it and they go, what? Israel is making mad Iran or mad Iran? You know, it's just one. I wish I could just make T-shirts, like bumper sticker of all these things that I'm always thinking of.
Do you think that's the same zone of your mind where you kind of learn multiple languages growing up, where you kind of look at different words?
Yeah, absolutely. So everywhere I go, if there's a new language, I want to speak it. So I'm fluent in those four, but I took German for almost 4 years, and I had a German girlfriend for 5. I could understand everything.
When she was mad, you got it.
Yeah, it's just weird.
When she was throwing things at your head, you understood.
Yo, shit. And I'm like, okay, I'm definitely don't want to use somebody's language if they speak mine or like an English, because then it's so slow. Yeah, langsam, right? But, but when I was in Thailand, I picked up enough Thai to talk with, you know, the market or the servers that didn't speak English. Enough to tell them exactly like I want this or this order or the cleaning or my name is or today it's raining. Because I enjoy using other people's languages.
You know, having a name called Today Is Raining is, you know, that's a Wani, tough name to have.
I know, it's Wani Akadima. Wani Fontok. Fontok in Thai is rain. I can still remember that after like 14 years. It's crazy.
Is it? Well, it's been raining a lot in Chicago lately, so maybe that's why. Fernando Beteta, thank you very much for being here today.
Absolutely.
Tenzing Wines and Spirits, education man, social media maven, and all-around good guy. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was our road trip to Chicago. What'd you think? Seems like I got pretty good feedback. You know, I went out there, talked to some people at the 750 launch party, and it was some really good vibe in the room. Met a lot of interesting people, heard some interesting comments, and I was reminded again that as interesting as it is, wine as a subject, something else that we often forget is how complicated and interesting and intricate it can be to sell wine and how wine moves through and how, in a way, distribution of wine is also the destiny of that wine, no matter how good or how bad it might be. To me, it's fascinating. I don't know. I think about it sometimes. I hope you enjoyed the segments. We had 9 episodes for you on the great city of Chicago. Some really interesting people. I think we hit it up pretty nice. Nice mix. What do you think, though? I'd be curious. This is the first time we really took the show on the road for any extended period of time, did a focus set in a different city. How'd you feel about it? Did you like it? Leave us a note on iTunes. Tell us what you thought. Send me a message in Gmail. I'm around. I'd be curious what your thoughts are. Maybe we'll do it again one day. Who knows? Maybe we'll hit the highway one more time. We got the equipment now. Hey, it's a big world out there. Maybe we'll go find it. Huh? You can come along for the ride if you want to. All you need is some listening time. Which brings us to, if you're curious about what we're up to in the future, check us out on Facebook, give us a like, and you'll see all our fancy, fancy posts. It's I'll Drink to That, Talking Wine with Levy Dalton is a Facebook fan page. Hey, fan page. Yeah. We're on Twitter at Drink to That Pod. And we're also up on Instagram. Some pretty artistic shots sometimes. Sometimes not. Sometimes good, though. At Levy Opens Wine. And then I got to tell you, we're also got our own website there. It's alldrinktothatpod.com where you can stream stuff off of it or download direct episodes so you don't have to go through iTunes if you don't want to. We like to give options. We're about options here. So lots to do, lots to think about. Maybe you want a t-shirt. Maybe you like a fancy, fancy, well, they're not that fancy, but they're pretty cool. I'll Drink to That t-shirt of your very own in a variety of different colors, shapes, sizes, onesies even. I mean, you can get onesies, you can get tanks, you can get biker tanks, you can get tees, you can get other stuff, hoodies, for God's sakes. It's all up there. You can find the information up on our website if you'd like to check it out and wear what you hear. And then there's also that possibility you could shoot us some real support. Shoot us a little dough. Help keep the microphones rolling. We are here because of dedication, because of love, because of interest. But we're also here because we make the finances work, and we could always use a little help with that. Thanks for your consideration.